From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
Why, hello there. Get yourself ready for an hour of news and views, vegetarian cheesesteaks. Kind of an oxymoron, actually, if you think about it. It's the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Luke Burbank.
I'm Allison Stewart. I don't mind the tofurkey. I'm not against the not dog.
Not,
every now again.
Not dog? Is that like N-A-U-G-H?
Exactly.
How clever.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the most veggie-friendly ballparks coming up on the show, as well as something that, it's a story you pitched. Because we've been talking a lot about the tragedy that happened in Newark, those students being shot.
Mm-hmm.
But you wanted to explore it a little bit further, the gang connection.
Yeah, and we wanted to do it last week, but then we had the show was too packed. And then over the weekend, the New York Times wrote a big article about it. But I just want to say Bryant Park Project was way out in front of that story, even though we're doing it after the New York Times. It's actually about this gang, MS-13, Mara Salva Trucha. They started out in L.A. A lot of the members got sent to El Salvador, where they got even more hardcore. And mm-hmm. Now this gang may or may not be spreading throughout the country, so we're going to talk about that a little bit.
We're also going to talk about, I don't know what the deal is with rich people and being mean to animals. You have Michael Vick, obviously that story, but there is this creepy story out of northern New Jersey about this well-heeled couple who, let's put it this way, they rescued, they being the police, 113 cats from their home.
Oh,
that's all I'm saying.
Man.
We'll get to the details in just a little bit.
Yeah, speaking of cruelty to animals, well, or children anyway, possible cruelty. There's this new CBS show called Kid Nation where they basically dropped 40 kids off in the middle of nowhere, New Mexico, and said, run your own town for 5 weeks. And now people are saying it was cruel and they violated child labor laws. So we're going to talk about that a little bit with Sarah Bunting from Television Without Pity.
Somebody read Lord of the Flies. And to finish things off, musician Josh Ritter is going to perform live in the studio as a new album called The Historical Conquest of Josh Ritter. Plus, we'll have all the news with Mr. Matt Martinez. But right now, it's time for today's top story. The big story today, Mother Nature is in a really, really, really bad mood this summer. I don't know, Luke, have you seen this video of people in the Midwest literally being plucked off the top of their roofs by
yeah.
National Guardsmen? And it's all across the world, from China, these huge torrential rains, to Peruvian earthquakes, to floods here in the States.
Yeah, it's weird because you think that summertime, usually you're hearing drought and everything, but it seems like everyone's getting flooded out right now. Here in the States so far, by the way, 22 people have died in the aftermath of two big storm systems that moved through the Midwest. That was in Ohio and Iowa. Meanwhile, Wisconsin and Minnesota, the Red Cross has identified 4,200 affected homes. 256 of them are considered complete losses. A lot of them they can't even get into, like 475 of them aren't accessible. This is a local police officer in Bluffton, Ohio. He was surprised at what's been going on.
I've been working on the interstate for about 14 and a half years, and I've never seen boats on the interstate before. So we've never had water on the interstate like this before.
The storm has also been a pretty costly event. In Wisconsin, the governor says the damage could top $38 million so far.
Let's head south. Hurricane Dean is going to take another whack at Mexico. After hitting Mexico's coast as a Category 5 on Monday, Dean is projected to mainland Mexico by Wednesday afternoon near the country's only nuclear power plant.
Jeez.
It's also headed towards the Mexican oil production fields. An AP reporter says the locals, they're just ready.
People are constantly monitoring radio and TV and getting reports from the authorities, so they are aware of this and they compare this to a situation they have lived before.
It's the third most intense Atlantic hurricane to make landfall in recorded history. That's according to the National Hurricane Service. 13 people have already died in the Caribbean as a result of Dean.
Meanwhile, jumping across the globe to China, officials there say they're still trying to reach 181 men who are trapped in a flooded coal mine. Boy, it sounds familiar. There are torrential rains there that caused a river dam to break, which sent a bunch of water down into this two-mile shaft. Apparently, workers there have been trying to get through tons and tons of like mud and water, trying to get to these trapped guys.
And finally today, USAID, the U.S. government aid agency through international development, announced it's going to provide an additional $500,000 in assistance to Peru. It was a week ago today that 7.9 magnitude earthquake occurred about 125 miles south of the capital of Lima. At least 500 people were killed. And all of this, Luke, it brings me back to, you know, it's 2 years since Katrina, if you can believe it. And think about this, the hurricane season for the United States anyway, continues through November. So this story could be continued.
Yeah, we're coming up right on the Katrina anniversary, and I think there was, you know, even more storms after that, right?
There were.
Back then, so it seems totally possible.
So we could be revisiting this story again. So that's the big story for today.
This is NPR.
And here's the rest of the big news from NPR's Matt Martinez.
Thanks, guys. Here's what NPR News is following this morning. 14 American soldiers died when their helicopter went down in northern Iraq today. The helicopter was one of two taking part in nighttime operations. The military says it may have been a mechanical failure. There is no indication it was shot down. A declassified CIA report says that former CIA chief George Tenet failed to follow through on his 1998 declaration of war against al-Qaeda, and the agency diverted counterterrorism money for other uses in the years before September 11th. Current CIA Director Michael Hayden is not happy about the report and says the inspector general was flat wrong. President Bush will talk to the veterans of foreign wars today. He's expected to compare the Iraq War with past conflicts in Asia, including Vietnam. The president is also expected to argue that the troop buildup is helping bring former insurgents into the fight against al-Qaeda. A new report says that high blood pressure is being overlooked in kids and teens. Researchers at Case Western University published a study that says kids are getting chubbier and their blood pressure is rising. The team looked at 14,000 young people between the ages of 3 and 18. They found 507 cases of hypertension, three-quarters of which had previously been undiagnosed.
They tried to make me go to rehab, I said no.
Singer Amy Winehouse put her North American tour on hold. She cited health concerns, but it's not clear if it's because she finally said yes, yes, yes to rehab. Winehouse has talked publicly about her past battles with drugs and her love for alcohol and marijuana, but her publicist is denying the singer is in rehab, saying she's suffering severe exhaustion. I'm Matt Martinez, and you as always online at npr.org.
You know, that's why you should never record a song called They Try to Make Me Go to Rehab, because it just, you're just a sitting duck for radio shows like ours to make fun
and
of you.
It could be exhausting. It's tiring going to bars that often.
Famous people get exhaustion more than any. Have you ever heard of a normal person being hospitalized for exhaustion?
Hey, look, you know there's always a fancy suburb in a neighborhood. Like if you're from Michigan, it's Bloomfield Hills. In Seattle, what's the sort of Tony upscale neighborhood?
Mercer Island, which is where Bill Gates lives.
Where my best friend from college is from, actually. I didn't know it was that fancy.
Fancy pants.
Where I grew up in Jersey, there's a community up in Saddle River. Big old houses, beautiful land. Like P. Diddy has moved there. A lot of big football stars. Something very bizarre went on in Saddle River, New Jersey. A middle-aged couple who owned a house, a 20-room home, were charged with animal cruelty after 113 cats were rescued from this multi-million dollar place. Now, the house had basically just become a litter box with deposits, we'll call them, up to 6 inches high. Police also unfortunately found boxes with dead cats in them, at least 23 dead animals. James LaGrossa, chief of law enforcement for the Bergen County Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, was actually on the scene, and he joins us now on the phone. Chief LaGrossa, can you hear me?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning to you. In terms of your years in law enforcement, can you tell me where this fits in the I can't believe this scale?
This would probably be on the top of the scale. On a scale of 1 to 10, this is probably an 11. It's mind-boggling. I've had some of my officers at the scene look at the situation, and they've told me, Chief, I'm seeing this, but my mind just will not comprehend what I'm looking at.
So in terms of the animals that were in the house, were you able to get all the animals out? And was it as bad initially as you thought?
We were shocked when we first into the premises. So we've gotten 117 animals out of the house. That's 117 cats. We've gotten 6 dogs. We found 24 dead animals in the garage, and we still believe there's about a dozen or so more animals in the house that we're trying to trap at this point.
Because they're in the walls and things?
In the walls. I've had the power and the gas disconnected from the premises because I'm afraid of an animal biting a wire inside the wall and starting a house fire and being killed. So to protect the animals, what I've done is I've had the utilities disconnected, and we're continuing to rescue animals.
And in terms of the animals that have been rescued, are they available for adoption or?
Yes, they are. They're all available for adoption. They can call 201-573-8900. That's my dispatch. And They can leave a name and phone number, and someone will get back to them as far as adoption. We need the public's help on this. We're looking for good homes for these animals. They deserve better than they've had.
And in terms of the couple that owned this house, they've obviously been brought up on criminal charges, right?
Yes, yes. I've signed complaints against them for animal cruelty, and the punishment for each complaint is a $1,000 fine and 6 months in jail or community service. But right now, we've signed complaints, and more are to follow.
And before I let you go, in your professional opinion, do you consider this a crime, or is this just a case of really horrific negligence?
No, it's under the state law. It's a crime, and it's a crime against society. These animals are depend on us for their survival, and these animals were trapped in this home. And it's a crime, and it's a horrific crime. Perhaps this thing got out of control with 117 cats in a house. You can imagine what happened inside the house. So it is a crime as far as Title IV of the state of New Jersey, punishable by, again, $1,000 fine and 6 months of jail per count. And many more counts will be filed against this couple in the days to come.
James LaGrosse, the Chief of Law Enforcement for the Bergen County Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me on.
So, Luke, the owners of this house, you know, they were a fairly well-heeled couple,
right? Yeah, you showed
right?
me a picture right before the show of this house online, and it's a beautiful place.
He was an investment banker type with Merrill Lynch. She was a small business owner. Apparently, the wife was surprised when she showed up at the house and saw police and animal cruelty, animal prevention there.
You know, the thing about this is that I was just subletting this apartment. I just moved to New York and I had a temporary place. And there was one cat named Samson. Nice guy, really shedded a lot. I'm trying to imagine, 100 and how many cats?
The wire said 113, but the police chief just told us it's up to 117.
I don't know how anyone could think that there was anything normal about that many cats.
Well, we're going to talk to somebody who can maybe explain that just a little bit. Stephen Pitt is a forensic psychiatrist based out of Arizona, and he has experience profiling suspects in animal cruelty cases. Dr. Pitt, we had this well-heeled couple, this beautiful home, and this Tony neighborhood. How can someone look at a house full of 117 cats and not process that this is a problem?
Well, it does shock the conscience, as the chief said. The reality is there's a myriad of reasons why people get involved in animal hoarding, and there's different theories, different models. Some people think it's an addiction model. Some people think it's an obsessive-compulsive model. Some people think that there's a delusional or a psychotic component to it, and other people think that there's an attachment piece, that these are people who didn't have other good, stable relationships, so they are attracted to animals as the base. That said, what's stunning about this case is that the overwhelming majority of cases involving animal hoarding involve single people, not married couples, and certainly not couples. And so that's kind of the piece that throws the curveball here, if you will.
Something else I'm sort of interested about is the New York Times reported that many people had said this couple, that they were depressed. They'd come on hard times. This big, beautiful house had gone into foreclosure. Can someone escape or an animal cruelty charge with an insanity defense?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I mean, you're hitting on two pieces there. The first is it's not at all unusual for people who are involved in animal hoarding to have some type of mental illness or some type of mental disorder. That's not a shock. The issue of an insanity defense or a mental defense in chief is going to present some challenges, because first you have to establish that you have a mental defense, then you have to establish that you have a defect in reasoning, and then you have to be able to show that as a defect of that reasoning, you couldn't appreciate right from wrong, is generally the statute around the country. There's another component, a volitional component, in some jurisdictions, but prisons are filled with people that have mental illness, and prisons are filled with people that have a defect in reasoning. It's getting to that next level that becomes the highest hurdle and quite difficult.
I know that every case is obviously kind of different, but I mean, what is that point where someone sort of goes from being a little eccentric and, you know, mm-hmm. I've got three cats or five cats to, you know, sort of animal corpses? Is there like a tipping point somewhere where it starts to go really awry?
Well, that's a difficult question for me to answer, and it really is on a case-by-case basis. For a number of these people, it starts out as collecting a few animals. For some people, it's rescuing animals, and then they simply become overwhelmed. But the reality is, if you talk to these people and if you ask these people generally, do they think they're being cruel to animals, you will uniformly hear that they don't believe they are. They believe that they don't see the problem. They believe that they're do-gooders and that they're doing something that rescues animals and not exploiting animals. Although there is a subset of people who are exploit hoarders.
Dr. Stephen Pitt, forensic psychiatrist out of Arizona, we appreciate you sharing your expertise with us about this really kind of difficult subject. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care.
Hey, coming up, we've got the Ramble to talk about the latest crappy Chinese product. No, it's not a lead-filled baby bib or, magnets of death. It's an arm wrestling machine that's breaking people's arms.
We'll also have PETA's list of the most veggie-friendly ballparks.
And also we'll talk about this new CBS show, Kid Nation. I got to tell you, Allie, 40, tween kids.
Oof.
I have one tween kid in my life, and that's like one too many. I don't even want to know what was going down there. Anyway, there's lots of controversy about this new CBS show. We'll talk to Sarah Bunting of Television Without Pity about that.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Welcome on back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I was told explicitly we have to say from NPR News.
So, yes?
Yeah, or we don't get paid.
It's the rule?
Yeah, literally the checks
don't
clear.
Well, then say it again, because I'm renovating my house.
Exactly. Double it up. It's the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. In a little bit, we'll have some live music from Josh Ritter. He was in this. Did you hear him practicing before?
Yes.
I'm very
really
excited.
Good.
Really, really good. But right now, it's time to take a look at the news stories that make you go, It's a thing we like to call the Ramble.
You know, we should have that CNC Music Factory song if that's going to be the intro, things that make you go, There's a, all right. A blind golfer in Pennsylvania got a hole in one. 53-year-old Sheila Drummond is believed to be the first blind female golfer to ever get a hole in one. The two amazing things that emerge from this story. First of all, apparently a blind dude has already gotten a hole in one at some point. And there's a United States Association of Blind Golfers. Which it just, I was saying before the show, it would just be a totally different experience when you're, sighted and you hit the ball. I mean, when you're blind, it's like you're hitting it and then there's somebody who's telling you sort of how it went. I should just play blindfolded sometime to see what the experience is like. I think it's probably totally different.
You might enjoy it.
I might get a hole in one.
I'm going to talk about cats again. I just want people to know I am married and I don't have a lot of cats in my house. I'm just saying that.
She's married to a cat.
Cats apparently only retain certain type of information for 10 minutes. Here's the deal. So if you reason why a cat might look at you one day and go like, not that interested, and the next day really decide to rub up on you, the thing is they need physical clues. If they just see you 10 minutes later, no recollection. But if they jumped on your lap and they nuzzled, then they know who you are.
Yeah, seriously, who let the dogs out on this show? Every single story is about animals. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals has issued its annual list of most vegetarian-friendly ballparks. First place went to Citizens Bank Ballpark in Philadelphia, which is home of the Philadelphia Phillies, which is hilarious because, nobody loves their meat products like the Philadelphians, but they do have a wheat-based vegetarian cheesesteak, which apparently...
That just sounds nasty. But,
I know,
I'm
doesn't
sorry.
That seriously? Also, AT&T Park in San Francisco has a portobello mushroom sandwich and veggie sushi. That was the second on the list.
I think, in as far as the Bryant Park Project is concerned, San Francisco goes to number one. Veggie sushi, garlic fries?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to keep talking. Hey, Japanese arcades are removing their arm spirit arm wrestling game in which a person wrestles a mechanized arm because apparently three people had their arms broken by the machine. Although the company is saying if you have your arm broken, you're basically a girly man. Mm-hmm. So they said that anybody should be able to, any woman should be able to beat this machine.
Yeah, yeah. And listen, if don't break your arm. Just go home and watch Over the Top starring Sylvester Stallone and Dolly Parton. That's one of the greatest, probably only arm wrestling movies of all time. Oh, wait, was that Rhinestone? I don't know. Dolly Parton, Over the Top does have Sylvester Stallone in it. It does involve arm wrestling. It's much safer than Arm Spirit. That, by the way, is The Ramble.
This is our world. Kids can do just as much as adults can do.
I'm feeling, like, really stressed and really worried. It's just been really stressful and tough. I guess I'm just going to have to keep pushing.
As Martin Luther King Jr. said, I have a dream.
Yeah, that kid was white, by the way, just as an aside. CBS has a dream, too, that you're going to watch its new reality show, which comes out this fall. It's called Kid Nation. That was a little sound sampling of some of the clips from the actual show. What CBS did, well, this production company actually, was they stuck 40 kids between the ages of 8 and 15 mm-hmm. in the middle of nowhere, New Mexico, and they basically let them start their own town with no adult supervision.
Kid town.
Yeah, what could go wrong with that? Well, specifically, grease burning and three kids drinking bleach.
Oh, I thought you were going to say like candy for breakfast, lunch, and dinner would be the worst thing that could happen.
Yeah, you would hope that that would be as bad as it got. But in fact, there were a few things where it kind of got off the tracks. There now problems. New Mexico officials are saying that they're not sure if this show and the taping of this show actually violated child labor laws. And so CBS is, before the show even hits the air, having to sort of come out and defend itself a little bit. People also kind of wondering why a parent would even let their kid go on a like total sanctioned Lord of the Flies experiment. The answer is because it looks like awesome television, if you ask me.
And I would think, ka-ching.
Yeah, there's like a 4-minute preview on YouTube, which I watched, which I thought actually looked kind of good. But somebody who knows far more about TV, who actually watches it professionally, is Sarah Bunting. She writes for the website Television Without Pity, and she joins us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for coming back on.
No problem.
So
good to be here.
Kid Nation, did they actually leave these kids unattended out in like the desert? Or, I mean, there had to be a huge crew. There had to be grown-ups there, right?
Well, there had to be a huge crew. There had to be grown-ups. And there had to have been a contract the size of the Shanghai phone book that these parents were asked to sign. I just really... okay, first of all, with the bleach drinking, like...
Who hasn't?
Are you kidding? Like bleach is not an odorless fluid. Like why would you smell that and continue drinking it? This seems like Darwinism taking its course here.
Why does anybody do that though? I mean, haven't you ever drank milk because someone told you it was spoiled?
No, but I don't like milk, so that's a bad example. But yeah,
thanks.
It is
thanks
sort
for
of like,
me
hey,
out.
This I think this is spoiled. Smell this, but I don't understand why you would not, you know.
So you're putting it back on the kids a little bit, which actually is a fair point because we were saying in the meeting today that like you put 40 kids in any summer camp and there's bound to be some injuries. I mean at like
normal. Yeah, you're going to sprain ankles. You're going to have Indian burns of people falling out of bunk beds. And I mean disfiguring burns would be one thing. But if it's just grease spatter and maybe not be bringing a lawsuit when you voluntarily shipped your child during the school year, as I understand it, the middle of nowhere with no apparent adult supervision, like, this is what gets to you? Well, is that she got some grease on her while she was cooking, which...
Well, now, we should clarify for people that aren't totally up to speed. One of the kids did get some grease on her when she was cooking, and her mom hasn't actually filed a lawsuit, but she has registered a complaint with the state of New Mexico
right.
over this
Isn't
injury.
Isn't that how they found out about isn't that how the state found out that this had been going on?
Yeah, the state was a little bit in the dark about well, let's just talk about the show for a second. How did it actually work? I mean, are there kids getting voted off?
I don't work for CBS, so I can't really say. I'm going to find out with everyone else.
Oh, my gosh. Well, let me fill you in a little bit. They gave them an actual gold star. Like, it's a physical gold star that's worth $20,000. And it weighs, like, I don't know how much that much gold
those little
weigh.
Foil ones used to send me through the roof. I can't imagine if it actually was real and had money attached.
Yeah, it had a value. At the end of every week, they would let this little community of kids vote on who got to have this gold star. Have you seen any of this stuff on YouTube, or have you been reading about it, Sarah?
I've been reading about it, and I am someone who watched Brat Camp, which I believe was a summer reality burn-off last year, where troubled kids were sent on basically an outward-bound trip and told to straighten up or fly right, and, you know, there were many breakthroughs where they learned to get along with their parents, and then occasionally a kid would freak out and get kicked off, and I watched every episode. I was that one who actually watched it. I think that Kid Nation is going to be really interesting TV, but I'm not a parent myself, but I sort of don't understand how parents put their kids on a show like this. Or
do you think that all this attention is going to be good for CBS because more people are going to watch, or do you think that it's actually it might derail the whole thing?
Well, they say that there's no such thing as bad press, and perhaps initially that might be the case, that it would attract attention or viewers who are looking for a more train wrecky aspect of it that they might not have watched otherwise without the negative stories. But you know, it has to be an entertaining, well-edited show to keep the viewers, so I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, it looks very contrived. Parts of it are super corny, and yet watching this preview, I totally started tearing up at this one point where a kid says he wants to go home to see his brother who's in a wheelchair, and then the other kids hug him.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
I'm not – yeah. Oh, that's fine. You know, mock me on national internet radio. Just go for that, Sarah. Sarah Bunting is a writer for the website.
I was groaning in sympathy.
Oh, that's what that was. Okay, thank you. Sarah Bunting is with Television Without Pity, joining us here to talk about Kid Nation. Thank you very much, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR.
Coming up in about 90 seconds, we'll talk to a West Coast street gang that's making waves on the East Coast. They're called MS-13, but right now let's get a quick look at the headlines. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson is trying to calm investors. He says the U.S. will, quote, work through the problems of a turbulent credit market just fine. He gave an interview to CNBC yesterday and said there's no quick solution. Home foreclosure filings nearly doubled in July from the same time about a year ago.
14 American soldiers are dead after their Black Hawk helicopter went down in northern Iraq today. They were taking part in a nighttime operation. The military says there is no indication that it was shot down.
A declassified CIA report says former CIA Chief George Tenet diverted counterterrorism money for other uses in the years before the September 11th attacks. It also says the agency had intelligence reports on two of the September 11th hijackers and failed to alert the FBI to the threat. Current CIA Director Michael Hayden says the report is, quote, flat wrong. And you can always find the news online at npr.org.
A guy named Melvin Jovell made his first court appearance yesterday. He's the sixth and final suspect in the execution-style triple murder of three college students that happened a couple weeks ago in Newark, New Jersey. It's been getting a lot of attention. We've been talking about it on this show. One of the suspects – this is one of the weird things that happens in this day and age. It's very terrible crime. One of the suspects has a MySpace page.
Hmm.
You know, where he's talking about this gang called MS-13.
Now, you're familiar with MS-13. It was something that when we read the story, a lot of people in our meeting hadn't really ever heard of them before.
Yeah, I'm being recently transplanted from Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and the neighborhood I lived in Los Angeles is right by where this gang MS-13 actually started out back in the sort of late 70s mm-hmm. and 80s. But it's kind of news to people on the East Coast that there might be a possibility that this MS-13 is kind of spreading around the country. It started off with guys from El Salvador who were living in Los Angeles, and they were sort of getting beat down by local gangs, and so they said, we got to start a gang. Now they say there's something like 10,000 MS-13 members in America. There's a lot more of them in El Salvador. It's not actually obvious if these people were really in MSN, mm-hmm. MS-13. I almost said MSNBC. Been watching too much of you on
Countdown.
It's
a gang of sorts.
Yeah, sort of.
We're not any kind of dangerous, though.
It's not really clear
other people.
if they're actually in MS-13 or if they're just wannabes. But either way, the question is, like, what's going on with this gang? And also, I'm kind of wondering if with the immigration from Latin American countries, if this mostly Latin American mm-hmm. gang is going to be the Bloods and the Crips of the 2000s, mm-hmm. you know, going forward. So we've got somebody on the line who knows a lot about this stuff. Celeste Freeman is the editor of WitnessLA.com. She reports on gangs in L.A., including MS-13. Hi, Celeste.
Hi there.
Thanks for coming on the show.
I'm delighted to be here, even though we're talking about something that still is just so devastating to everyone who reads about these kids.
Yeah. People, as we were saying earlier, from Los Angeles and the West Coast have probably heard about these guys, MS-13, but it's pretty new out here on the East Coast. Can you kind of give us the story on how this gang got founded?
Well, I think you were actually outlining it pretty well. MS-13 was just another gang that started when you had a lot of immigrant kids who were feeling very pressed, getting beat up, feeling that they had no space for themselves, so they formed a gang, as is usually the genesis of gangs. But what has happened with, and these were El Salvadorian kids, but what happened with MS-13 is a lot of these families were undocumented, got deported, and then the kids would find themselves back in El Salvador, and the only thing that they really had of value that they brought with them, unfortunately, was their gang. And so we exported MS-13 to Central America, and now it's taken root in a big way down there. It was affected by all of the political violence in El Salvador, and so then came back to the U.S. In a much more politicized and virulent form.
The requirements have been changed over time. It started out you had to be from El Salvador or El Salvadoran descent. Now then it was you just have to be from Central America. Now it's like anyone can be. And are they trying to franchise?
Well, there's always a lot more organization placed on these gangs than it's disorganized crime to so much of an extent. For example, when this whole thing happened with the Newark murders, mm-hmm. And the police began making arrests, and then, you know, this 28-year-old was arrested, and there was a suggestion that he was with MS-13, and then, as you said, there were the MySpace pages of the 15-year-olds trying to look all bad and suggesting that now they were from Mara Salvatrucha. I called Alex Sanchez, who's a gang intervention specialist in L.A., but a guy who is a former gang member and is from El Salvador, so his connections with MS-13 are only 1,000 times better than mine. And mm-hmm. I said, Alex, what do you think? He said, the guys that on the street have been talking about this. They're as perplexed and horrified as we are, and they have absolutely zero contact from an organizational perspective with anybody in Newark. So there may very well be a group that has somehow sort of started itself up where someone has moved to New Jersey or a neighboring state and decided to start their own little thing.
So this may not necessarily be evidence of these guys in L.A., you know, orchestrating these sort of killings on another coast. It could be a lot looser than that.
Oh, God, no. No, honestly, this is so atypical. What I think that we're seeing two 15-year-olds and a 16-year-old that came under the influence of some true predators. The 28-year-old and the 24-year-old seem to be the real thing. I mean, this is psychopathic behavior. This isn't gang behavior. To go out and rob some college students who at the most are going to have a few gold chains, some cell phones, and some pocket change. And that they line them up and do execution style killings. It's just, as I said, the actual gangs on the street are as perplexed by this behavior. This is predatory behavior. It's not gang behavior. I mean, gang behavior can be very predatory, but it's dealing in drugs and shooting at each other, and innocent people get killed, and it's tragic and horrible, but it's like any other organization, legal or not. It has its own logic, and this falls very much outside a gang logic. What were those 15-year-olds doing hanging out with a 28-year-old? You would have the 28-year-old sending the youngsters down to the corner to sell drugs, but they would not be socializing together. This is the youngsters would have their own little clique. There's something, very, very psychologically off here, well beyond the tragedy and violence we see with gangs.
Celeste Freeman is the editor of WitnessLA.com. She joined us talking about MS-13, a gang that may or may not have had any involvement in what just happened in Newark, New Jersey. Celeste, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Coming up, by the way, musician Josh Ritter. He'll be in the studio to perform live. Talk about his new record.
And a famous gay man died, and nobody mentioned that he was gay in his obituary. The co-author of Merv Griffin's autobiography will be here in the studio to talk about all things Merv. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. That's a little Merv Griffin for you. Allie, did you know he started out as a lounge singer?
Oh, didn't we all?
I didn't know that until I was reading all the obituaries. That
didn't
last
we all
day.
Start out as lounge singers?
Oh, yeah. another thing that I guess a lot of folks didn't know is that by all sort of indications, Merv Griffin was also gay. And a lot of the obituaries that were written about him last week kind of skipped that part. And we were wondering if that even mattered. I mean, is that a relevant piece of information when you're writing about Merv Griffin's life?
I know. Would you have written if he were completely straight, Merv Griffin, straight entrepreneur and rich man, or
right.
not?
Yeah. I guess that's one argument. And in fact, a lot of Merv Griffin's friends were pretty up in arms when The Hollywood Reporter wrote an article that sort of outed Merv Griffin. And it was actually a really affectionate piece, but it did mention very explicitly that this guy was probably gay. It got pulled from their website, then it got put up later on. So we wanted to talk to somebody who actually knew Merv Griffin, and we wanted to sort of find out what he thought about it. And we've got just that guy here. His name's David Bender. He's the co-author with Merv Griffin of Merv, Making the Good Life Last. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Thanks for coming on. You knew Merv Griffin really well.
I did know Merv, and I have to say, I want to question a couple of premises. One is that in your introduction before, you said this is a gay man. Merv didn't declare himself to be a gay man. I worked with him for mm-hmm. a year and a half, and that was never a discussion. I'm an openly gay man. I make no bones about it and have been out for 25 years. I've worked in the gay community. Merv did not. identify as a gay man, never said that he was to me, and it seems to me that what's difficult about this process is not so much the issue of whether or not there's anything wrong with it. Of course there's not. But he did not choose to identify. And, you know, so I don't know what the truth is, but I will, you know, any more than Allison, you've said to me, you know, you haven't said you're gay. Mm-hmm. I won't assume it. It's your right to declare who you are, what your sexual orientation is, your religion. I often make this case and this analogy to religion.
Well there's certainly a theoretical possibility that he's not gay. But, I mean, based on everything you know about him, David, you to me, being honest, it's more than likely the guy is gay.
Actually, I completely disagree with that.
Do you think he might have been straight?
Here's the evidence. The evidence is he was married for 18 years. Mm-hmm. He has a son, two grandchildren. I had on my radio show 2 nights ago the woman who was his fiance in the 50s.
Well, then how did this whole thing get started?
This whole thing got started by people who decided to declare a label for a person who eschewed labels. Merv spent his entire life in public, in the public eye, and one of the things we talked about in the book he was very proud of was that people in the 60s and 70s, when he had his talk show, and by the way, he wasn't a lounge singer, he was a big band singer, and a big band singer is a very big deal back in the 50s. He was like a rock star of the day. So he was a very famous guy when he was 18, 19 years old. Then in the 60s, he got a talk show. He was as big for a time as a Johnny Carson or as a Jay Leno would be today. Uh-huh. And what he did with that platform in the 60s and 70s is he put people on of very diverse opinions. He put on Jane Fonda and Muhammad Ali against
the war in
Vietnam.
I used to watch the Merv Griffin show when I used to get home from school.
Absolutely. And you saw, well, we all did. And you saw that what he did and what he was proud of, look, was he actually didn't let anyone know what his personal opinions and views were. He kept that out so he could actually have people feeling comfortable talking to him. He did not put his private life, private political opinions, for example, forward. So he had liberals who thought he was a conservative, conservatives who thought he was a liberal, and he loved that.
So
he was proud of that.
Do you think the Hollywood Reporter erred by printing that original story? Did they do the wrong thing or the right thing or the journalistic thing?
Ray Richardson, who wrote it, loved Merv, and as you say, the piece was very affectionate. It was not meant as a slam. This was his view. Here's mine. My view is that this is a man who did not use labels in the way you and I. He was born in 1925.
Yeah, but what did you think about what the Hollywood Reporter did?
I think that their reaction to it was a little bit panicky. They first put it on because they thought this was a perfectly loving piece, and then they took it off because they felt that they were being offensive in some way, which is offensive to me because, again, there's nothing wrong with this. But here's a point I want to make sure we get out here, which is that this is a man who, because of his life, his era, he chose to live his life the way he did and did not see himself the way I see myself as a gay man. I can tell you that as a matter of practical fact. And that is an identity question. And, you know, what he saw is he's a man who had been married for 18 years, who loved women, whether he loved men. I know, I can tell you how he was to me. He was a great friend, very supportive. There had been some talk that he was uncomfortable around gay people. Nothing could be further from the truth from my working with him and writing his book for you.
Well, so do you think, and we're actually already out of time now, and you're cutting into Josh Ritter's time, who's sitting right there. So,
sorry, Josh, I'll shut up.
Don't get a guy with a guitar mad at you. But here's the last question, David. Is it whether he was gay or identified as gay or whatever his particular setup was it relevant to talk about that in the obituary somewhere?
I think it's relevant to talk about a life in the way the person lived it. And he chose to live his life the way he did. He did not live his life as a public gay man. And therefore, I think that's the relevancy. You make that choice.
Yeah. David Bender, author of co-author with Merv Griffin of Merv, Making the Good Life Last. David, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
This is NPR.
Coming up, we're going to be talking to a fellow named Josh Ritter about some music that he's making. really good music. I heard him warming up before the show. First, though, I think we're going to take a really quick check of the day's headlines with Matt Martinez. Is that going to happen?
That's right. That is going to happen. Good morning, everyone. 14 soldiers are dead after the Black Hawk went down in northern Iraq. The military does not suspect it was shot down. A new declassified report bashes the CIA. It says the agency had pre-9/11 intel they never used. The current CIA chief calls it flat wrong. Kids are getting fatter and not getting checked for high blood pressure, and they should be. That's according to a new report. And the boss of the Utah coal mine where six miners are trapped, says he emotionally came apart after a second cave-in killed three rescuers and that he was under a doctor's care for several days. These stories are always online at npr.org. I'm Matt Martinez.
Guitars, pianos, horns, and lyrics about the dog days of summer and ladies' underwear make up what's being called Josh Ritter's most adventurous release yet, called The Historical Conquests of Josh Ritter. He's been described as a singer-songwriter, alt-country or folk. You decide. All these kids that think they're quick on the draw, always shooting at outlaws. I'm busy keeping my cool cocked. I'm gonna know you when you finally come, 'cause I got you in my mind's eye. I got you in my mind. Maybe none of those labels apply. The name of that song is Mind's Eye from the new record. Josh Ritter joins us at the Bryant Park Project Studios. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm doing okay. So when you hear people try to decide, oh, should this be in the folk bin singer-songwriter bin or the alternative bin, where do you think your music should be?
I think it's rock and roll with lots of words. That's what it would be.
The Josh Ritter bin.
If I couldn't be a lounge singer or a big band singer.
Dude, not lounge singer, big band.
Okay.
There's a big difference.
Josh, this is your fourth studio album, right?
Yeah, it is.
Okay,
yeah.
Just wanted to make sure. Checking the internets, the interwebs, you can get confused that way. The Washington Post described it as your most freewheeling of records, unfussy orchestral pop to unfettered rock and roll. So was it your intention to make this big old stew of a record?
Yeah, I made a record last year put out called The Animal Years that was really, I thought it was really, you know, I spent a lot of time on every little tiny bit and getting lots of things just how I wanted them, because I wanted all the songs to fit together and that sort of thing. You react to it by kind of wanting to, you know, blow something up, mm-hmm. you know, and punch a wall on occasion, you know, and that's sort of what I wanted this record to sound like, was just, you know, having fun. And, you know, we did it up in Maine at a, you know, 10 below zero with BB guns, and it was really fun.
Yeah, it's interesting. It was the Great North Sound Society. It's kind of newish facility. It sounds like a really interesting place to make a record. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, it's a farmhouse from 1790, and the walls are papered with old, I think it was the Boston Advertiser, you know, with Stephen Crane short stories on the walls and all these, you know, just stuff that was, you know, when you take away all the plaster and things, it was just used to line the walls to keep the wind out. So you look at all these great old stories about, like, you know, all this stuff about the exposure of mania and pregnant women in 1890 and all this crazy stuff. It's amazing.
So it must have seeped into the new record
a little bit.
Let's hear a song from the record. Which one do you want to do first?
I'll do To the Dogs or Whoever.
Okay.
Deep in the belly of a whale I found her, down with the deep blue jail around her, running her hands through the ribs of the dark, Florence and Calamity and Joan of Arc. I love the way she looks in her underwear, lose my page in the plot in the book, then I swear she makes the most of her time, but loving me plenty, she knows there'll come a day when we won't be getting any. Stain of the sepia, the butcher cried me through the wreck of a brass band. I thought I could see her in a kickwalk. She came through the dead and the lame, just a little bird floating on a hurricane. I was flat on my back, my feet in the thorns. I was in between the apples and the chloroform. She came to me off and I was sure I was dying. It was always hard to tell if she was laughing or crying. I thought I heard somebody calling in the
dark, I thought I heard somebody call. Joan never cared about the in-betweens. Combed her hair with the blade at the Maid of Orleans. Said Christ walked on water, we could wade through the war. You don't need to tell me who the fire is for. And bring me a love that could sweeten the sword. A boat that can love the rocks of the shore. The love of an iceberg reaching out for the wreck. Can you love me like the crosses love the nape of the neck? Was it Casey Jones, the Casey at the bat, who died out of pride and got famous for that? Killed by a swerve, laid low by the curb. Do you ever think they ever thought they got what they deserved? Don't pity the bullet, pity the man. They both find a place in the same sad plan. Both are like the barrel going over the falls, crying all the way down. I never asked to be involved. I thought I heard somebody calling. In the dark, I thought I heard somebody call. General George began the day by taking pink little pills. Sent his men through the top of some hell of a hill. Through the whisper of trees came artillery breeze. Said I love the way the wind comes tickling my knees. Jane shot the apple right between the eyes. I was thinking of her when you came outside. Lemonade on your breath, sun in your hair. Did I mention how I love you in your underwear? Deep in the belly of a whale I found her. Down with the deep blue jail around her. Running her hands through the ribs of the dark. Bones of calamity of Joan of Arc. I thought I heard somebody call. Dark, I thought I heard somebody call. I thought I heard somebody call, man. Dark, I thought I heard somebody call.
I mean this in the absolute, absolute best way, but that sounds to me like a kind of like a Bob Dylan record that it's like a 45, but somebody put it on 78,
or whatever the faster
version is.
It's hard not to keep on speeding it up. I think I like it when it goes really fast, lots of words.
You better play that song last, because if you're gonna be out of breath, like at your show. I'm glad that I'm giving you advice, like I even know.
No, it's so much fun to play this stuff live. It's just kind of wild music, you know. And I always started. I really started up in, you know, coffee houses, you know, where, you know, there's no liquor and everybody plays very quietly. You know, this is really fun for me.
Well, you grew up in Idaho, right?
Yeah,
and I've
yeah.
been to Moscow, Idaho.
You
so
have?
I know it's not a whole lot of folks up in Moscow, Idaho.
Wow, that's amazing. You're there.
It's beautiful. Okay. Beautiful. But I'm curious how growing up in sort of a remote area mm-hmm. like that really shaped the way that you developed your music and you learned to write.
I think mostly like the amount of free time that you have and the inability to get in any kind of trouble, which is like, you know, there's just nothing out there to get in trouble with. I started playing guitar because, you know, I lived way out of town and there was nothing really else to do, you know. And I mean, we threw rocks at rocks most of the time, you know. That was
Done.
Yeah. There's a team, you know, and so
it's a team sport there in Moscow.
Huge.
It is Moscow, Idaho.
Moscow is great. It's kind of like where that's the epicenter of Northern Idaho, but the littler towns around there, we've got Harvard and Beauville and Yale and Vassar and Princeton. There's all these like little Ivy League college towns around there, which are fantastic to go to, and you should come out if you have a chance.
Go to Winchester, population 262. I spent a night in Winchester.
Did you listen to a lot of Built to Spill? Because that guy, Doug Marsh, he writes about Idaho all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Those guys are great, you know, and I think that, you know, there's a lot of stuff. I always feel like no matter where I go, I always have like a fair amount of Idaho in my music that comes out, you know, just because it's just, I first came to New York on St. Patrick's Day in I think 1999, and I got lost in Central Park, and a bunch of Lebanese guys wearing shamrock hats helped me find my way out.
Had you been drinking? Are you sure?
Yeah.
No. Are you sure?
It was a fun. It's always amazing to come to New York, you know. And but I'm really glad to still be out in Idaho and having that time alone to kind of write and things.
Luke mentioned that obviously Bob Dylan, one of your influences, and it's cool when you go on Amazon.com, they asked you about music that people should listen to, and you mentioned Dylan, you mentioned Bach, but you also mentioned Nina Simone.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick listen to a track from Nina Simone for people who aren't familiar.
I say, oh, Baltimore, ain't it hard?
So what is it about Nina Simone and this track that really moves you? Do you think people need to hear it?
Well, I mean, I love the sound of her voice. And for me, you know, I don't have like a real pretty voice, but I really love the way that she has this like, she could say anything and I would know what she was saying. You know, like when she sings like, I put a spell on you or something, it sounds like she's just grown nails and she's about to pluck out your eyes, you know. And something like Baltimore, you know, I just know what she's talking about. I mean, she, even if I'd never been to Baltimore, I would know what she meant, you know. And she also had this way of finding songs like Randy Newman, of songwriters, and just and finding something totally new in them that wasn't there before. I love her music.
Well, before we let you go, we're going to ask you to play one more song for us. It is going to be "The Temptation of Adam." What's this about?
Yeah, this is a song about falling in love in a missile silo.
You know what, Ali? Before he starts playing, let's just say you've been listening to the Bryant Park Project. This is Josh Ritter. He's got a new record coming out, "The Historical Conquests of Josh Ritter." You can check him out at joshritter.com. And why don't you play us on out?
Thanks a lot, you guys, for having me here. It's...
If this was the Cold War, we could keep each other warm. I said on the first occasion that I met Marie, we were crawling through the hatch that was the missile silo door, and I don't think that she really thought that much of me. I never had to learn to love her like I learned to love the bomb. She just came along and started to ignore me. But as we waited for the big one, I started singing her my songs. I think she started feeling something for me. We passed the time with crosswords that she thought to bring inside. What five letters spell apocalypse, she asked me. I won her over singing W-W-I-I-I. Oh, she smiled and we both knew that she'd misjudged me. Oh, Marie, it was so easy. Fall in love with you, it felt almost like a home of sorts or something. And you would keep the warhead missile silo good as new, and I'd watch you with my thumb above the button. Then one night you found me in my army issue cot, and you told me of your flash of inspiration. You said fusion was the broken heart that's lonely's only thought. All night long you drove me wild with your equations. Oh, Marie, do you remember all the time we used to take? We'd make our love and then ransack the rations. And I think about you leaving now, and the avalanche cascades, and my eyes get washed away in chain reaction. Oh, Marie, if you would stay, then we could stick pins in the map of all the places where you thought that love would be found. But I would only need one pin to show where my love's at, in a top secret location 300 feet under the ground. Oh, we could hold each other close, we'd stay up every night looking up into the dark like it's the night sky. Pretend this giant missile is an old oak tree instead, and carve our name in hearts into the warhead. Oh, Marie, there's something tells me things just won't work out above, that our love would live a half-life on the surface. So at night while you are sleeping, I hold you closer just because. As our time grows short, I get a little nervous. So I think about the big one, W-W-I-I-I, would we ever really care? The world had ended. And you could hold me here forever, like you're holding me tonight. I think about that great big button, and I'm tempted.
I wish I knew how to whistle through my teeth, but I don't. This has been the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.